actually 50 years ago today that the world first heard the Beatles' landmark album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. May 26th, 1967, it was released in the UK. It wasn't released in the United States until about a week later. I've invited Jack Hamilton to come on and talk about this today. Jack is the pop critic for Slate.com. He's also an assistant professor of media studies and American studies at the University of Virginia and author of the rock and roll book Just After Midnight. Hi, Jack. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on, Paul.
Well, thanks for joining me here today. I read a piece that you wrote about Sgt. Pepper's for Slate this week in which you said it was a musical masterpiece that doubled as a masterpiece of timing. What do you mean by that?
Well, basically, I mean, Sgt. Pepper was really, you know, it's one of these works of art that really hit at the perfect moment. It released into a moment where people were really ready to start taking rock and roll music seriously as a sort of sophisticated form of art. It was also, you know, obviously it's released at the kind of height of the Beatles. Popularity, the height of their powers, also at this very interesting turning point in their career, where everyone was sort of hanging on what they were going to do next. They had already announced that they were stopping touring, and in the mid-1960s, for a rock and roll band to say that they were not going to tour anymore, most people were like, well, then what's the point? You know, like, how does a band persist if they're not playing live? And so, yeah, I mean, Sgt. Pepper is really, it's released into this world that is, you know, that's really ready for a sort of a work of rock and roll that it can embrace as sort of sophisticated, embrace as a masterpiece. And there had certainly been great rock albums prior to Sgt. Pepper, but none that were really received in the same way. You know, this was an album that was, you know, rapturously reviewed in these sort of major media outlets that had never really thought to, you know, to write about rock and roll, certainly not in the terms that they described Sgt. Pepper. So it's like, you know, it's just, you know, it's a masterpiece work that also, yeah, comes along, really hits at the perfect time, which certainly does not take anything away from the music itself.
Even Pet Sounds, which was the landmark Beach Boys album that preceded Sgt. Pepper into the marketplace and was said by Paul McCartney to be a major influence on the work that he and John Lennon did in writing Sgt. Pepper's, that was not a hit album, Pet Sounds.
Yeah, no, Pet Sounds was kind of a flop, you know, and particularly in relationship to the Beach Boys' previous music. Pet Sounds came out and was treated sort of curiously. It was seen as kind of weird. It was definitely seen as a departure from their previous music. I mean, another important part of this is that the LP as a format was something that in the mid-1960s, it was still a really new idea that this would be a format that would really lend itself to rock and pop music. The LP is a format, you know, the sort of long-playing vinyl record was something that was very much associated with genres like classical and jazz, and, you know, hadn't even been around that long itself. It debuted in 1948. And rock and roll and pop were really seen as singles medium. So, yeah, with an album like Pet Sounds, I mean, part of it was that I think it was seen as a sort of weird departure from the Beach Boys' previous music, but also the Beach Boys were seen as a singles act. You know, they were seen as sort of like, and, you know, certainly, you know, Pet Sounds had great singles, Wouldn't It Be Nice, and Sloop John B., and God Only Knows. But, yeah, this was not, you know, people didn't think of the Beach Boys as an album band.
And what's funny about Sgt. Pepper is, you talk about it being the first that really embraced the album format. Was there a single released from that album?
No, there wasn't. Another thing that's very important about it. They had previously, earlier in 1967, the Beatles had released the double A-side single of Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane. That was the sort of run-up to Sgt. Pepper. But yeah, neither of those songs are actually on Sgt. Pepper.
And why is that? If they were done during the same sessions and part of the same creative spurt from Lennon and McCartney, why weren't they included on the album?
You know, there's a lot of different stories about that, and some people have come out and said that some people had wanted them on the album. I actually, frankly, don't. I've never heard a really definitive reason for why those singles are not on the album. I mean, part of it might have just been that you know, EMI, their label, wanted to put something out. You know, this is something that one of the things about the singles market really driving rock and pop music in the 60s was that it was something where you really had to put something out every 3 or 4 months or else you were seen as dormant. You know, so it was this kind of like, and this is really what leads to this sort of staggering productivity of so many 60s artists, is this necessity that like every 3 or 4 months you look at the Beatles' career really prior to Sgt. Pepper, and it's really working on that model of just putting something out, you know, just like constantly, you know, like once something leaves, once a song starts falling from the charts, you put another one in.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Hey, Jack, this is Dan. I have a question. Now, the Beatles, sure, on Sgt. Pepper's, was this the very first time that they used new studio techniques like multi-tracking? And they recorded, they used a thing called pitch shifting, which, mm-hmm, actually recorded things in different speeds, in different tracks, in different speeds, which kind of made this kind of innovative, too, didn't it?
Sure. Yeah, it wasn't the first time that they had, the Beatles had actually been really at the forefront of a lot of this kind of interesting experimentation. I mean, I Feel Fine, which is from 1964, is one of the earliest pop songs to have have feedback on it. You know, that opening note of I Feel Fine, I mean, that's pretty groundbreaking. But Revolver, the album before Sgt. Pepper, certainly, I mean, Tomorrow Never Knows, which is the last track on Revolver, uses a lot of studio trickery and kind of really cutting edge gadgetry. But I do think Sgt. Pepper was the one. I mean, Sgt. Pepper, one of the things that's very famous about it was that they really explicitly set out to make an album that couldn't be performed live. Like, that was something that they were very interested in trying to do. So yeah, you know, these tracks, like a track like A Day in the Life, it's really hard to imagine that translating to live performance, or Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, or, you know, even a track like She's Leaving Home, which is one of the ones that in the original mix of She's Leaving Home, they sped up the tape speed on it. It's actually the original mix of She's Leaving Home is actually nine seconds shorter. The mono mix of it is 9 seconds shorter than the stereo mix, partly because, yeah, you know, they're messing around with speeds and things like that. But again, that's something that they had been doing, even on Rubber Soul, the piano solo on In My Life is sped up to make it sound kind of like a harpsichord.
Hmm.
Wow.
Now, speaking of the mix, I got to tell you, I'm a lifelong Beatles fan. I have owned Sgt. Pepper in maybe not every format it's been available. I didn't buy it in the mini disc version,
yeah.
but I owned it on the album, both in stereo and mono. Yes, I'm that guy. I owned it on cassette. I think I owned it on 8-track. I certainly still own it on CD. And now on my phone, I've got the digital download of the album because that was just easier to do from iTunes. But
right.
Now George Martin's son, Giles Martin, who worked with him on the remixes of all their music for the Beatles Love Show in Las Vegas, the Cirque du Soleil show out there, he's gone back for the 50th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper and remixed the album yet again. And I'm just going to say, I'm not falling for this. I am not buying this damn album a seventh time. Because I don't think I would hear anything different. You've actually listened to this new version, right?
Yeah.
And is it different?
It really is.
This
would be the one that I would say is worth all. And I am someone who is like, I'm like you, where I just roll my eyes at every time there's some new. And the Beatles are so guilty of this. I mean, I don't know if they're quite as guilty as the Rolling Stones, who have like remastered editions of their albums every like 5 years.
Yeah, they've remastered still, greatest hits albums, the Stones.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. But yeah, this one is actually, and like the reason that this one is a pretty big deal is sort of, as you mentioned, the distinction between mono and stereo, which, and this is getting into kind of the weeds of Beatle, you know, sort of marginalia, but so the Beatles in the 60s mixed most of their albums in mono because that was the technology through which most people were listening to music. So the Beatles, the final mixes of the Beatles albums, the ones that the Beatles were really involved with, were the mono mixes. This is true up until Abbey Road was the first album that they mixed in stereo. They then made these stereo mixes after the fact, like, you know, that George Martin and the engineer would just sit down and kind of knock off. Like, and this was sort of like, you know, they would do those after the Beatles had sat down and really painstakingly worked with these mono mixes. when the albums got transferred to CD in the 80s, what got transferred were the stereo mixes instead of the mono mixes. So for years and years and years, the mono mixes, unless you had the original vinyl, were really lost to the world. And this was something that was, you know, this was how the Beatles wanted this music to be heard. And what's amazing, and the mono mix in Sgt. Pepper is the one that's very famous for being really different than the stereo mix. George Martin himself used to say that you hadn't heard Sgt. Pepper until you'd heard it in mono. He said that the distinction was that different. What Giles Martin did was go back and remix the stereo mix from the original materials to try to make it more faithful to all of the, and I mean, there's real creative differences. There's instruments that you can't hear on the stereo mix. You could hear on the mono mix. As I mentioned before, She's Leaving Home sounds completely different on mono than stereo. And this is stuff that Giles Martin has really managed to recover and make a new stereo mix that is much more faithful to the original mono, which means that it's much more faithful to how the Beatles wanted people to originally hear Sgt. Pepper.
All right, now here's another thing we need to talk about. When the album came out, it came with visuals, not just the famous album cover, but also the inserts that were in there, cut out so you could have your own little Sgt. Pepper mustache if you wanted to, and pictures of the band, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That whole idea of the concept of the Beatles didn't do the album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band did the album, this Paul McCartney creation. People call this a concept album, but the concept is really only there at the beginning and one song at the end. The rest of it is just Beatles songs in a random order, right?
Yeah, no, it's not. I actually think that calling Sgt. Pepper a concept album is really a misnomer.
It's not like Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah, there's not really a concept besides, as you mentioned, like the opening track and the second to last track, you know, which are like, it's not an album that has some sort of like really, you know, completely clear thematic unity or anything like that. So I don't entirely know why it gets sort of labeled with that term. I mean, I think part of it is that, you know, it was a real landmark in terms of it really insisting that it be taken as a whole. You know, again, like the not releasing a single, there was no way to own part of Sgt. Pepper without owning all of it, you know, and they didn't push a single to radio. So radio stations, I mean, when Sgt. Pepper came out, for the weeks afterwards, a lot of radio stations would just play the whole thing, like, which is crazy, you know, if you think about it. Like, it's like, a radio station just playing an album front to back. But that happened really frequently, and part of that was because they didn't know what part of it to play.
Yeah.
You know, like, it was like, so you just play the whole thing. So I think that's probably, you know, it's more like the album as a concept rather than the concept album.
I like that. That's a good way of putting it.
Now,
my wife asked me to ask you this. Do you think that the Beatles could have made Sgt. Pepper's without drugs?
You know, I don't know. That's a great question.
Here's why I'm asking it, Jack. Years ago, I interviewed Ray Manzarek, who was the keyboard player for The Doors, working with Jim Morrison and Robbie Krieger and John Densmore in The Doors. And I asked him if the Beatles were an influence on you, and he said, not the early Beatles, only the post-drugs Beatles. Because if you go back to I Want to Hold Your Hand and I Feel Fine and you know, the stuff that they did on their first few albums, they didn't really change the world all that much. It's once they got to Rubber Soul, Revolver, and particularly Sgt. Pepper's and then Abbey Road, that you could hear that they were thinking differently and something had happened to them mentally that had expanded the horizons of rock music inside their heads and thus influenced other people. You have to agree with that if Ray Manzarek says it, right?
I mean, one thing I would sort of push on, though, is that, like, I mean, not to, like, there were drugs around the Beatles the whole time. You know, this was something, and particularly in those early years, like, it's like they were amphetamines. That was like, you know, when they were first starting out, all the years, you know, the shows in Hamburg and Liverpool and stuff. Like, that was, you know, it was amphetamines and alcohol. And there's a way that that early Beatles music really evidenced that, too. You know, that sort of frantic, I mean, the sort of like, just that kind of, it's so energetic, you know, there's, and... Yeah, and so I think, I do think that it's, you know, there's definitely a shift that happens around, Rubber Soul, Help, you know, they had started smoking pot by the time Help came around.
And LSD.
I mean, and Sgt. Pepper is, you know, clearly, and I mean, it's often, yeah, I mean, it's one of the, it's a landmark of psychedelic rock. And like, what psychedelic rock? It's rock that is sort of indebted to the experience of psychedelic drugs.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right.
Here, so it's kind of hard to imagine it without it. Yeah.
Here's the last thing I wanted to ask you about. We could make a list of white rockers who were influenced heavily by the Beatles and particularly by Sgt. Pepper. But you wrote in your Slate piece this week that black artists, while they may have been influenced by it, were not allowed to emulate it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Yeah, well, there was because there was a longstanding bias in the music industry that really persisted until the early 1970s, and even persisted past that to in a lot of quarters that black audiences weren't going to buy albums. So that R&B was seen as a really singles-oriented medium. So that if someone, you know, like two people I mentioned in the article as being massively influenced by Sgt. Pepper, were Otis Redding, who died 6 months after it came out, but wrote Sitting on the Dock of the Bay while apparently listening to that album, listening to Sgt. Pepper over and over and over. And then Stevie Wonder was another one who was 17 when that album came out and talked about it as if it was like this sort of rapture moment for him. And Stevie Wonder obviously then later becomes a great album artist, and it's, you know, his later music becomes influenced by Sgt. Pepper, but he had to really kind of fight for that, you know, the ability to make albums, the ability to for Motown to let him really use the LP format, you know, in a way that was as sort of inventive and as kind of thorough as the Beatles, and as not as sort of like, you know, beholden to singles. And again, that was because his label, you know, Motown throughout the 60s in particular, saw albums as not moneymakers. They saw them as things that were kind of like, yeah, they were footnotes. You know, yeah, they were things that weren't really meant to, that wasn't what they saw themselves as doing, because they didn't see their audience as interested in purchasing those things. But then, you know, obviously this becomes rendered untrue when you think about the, in the 70s in particular, with the albums that people like Curtis Mayfield made, Isaac Hayes, you know, Sly and the Family Stone, obviously Stevie Wonder himself, plenty of others, that became huge, huge hits as R&B albums. But in the 60s, that really wasn't something that was allowed to happen.
Very interesting. Jack Hamilton is the pop critic for Slate.com, assistant professor of media studies and American studies at the University of Virginia, and author of the rock and roll book Just After Midnight. Thanks so much for joining me here today to talk about this, Jack.
All right. Thanks so much for having me on, Paul.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS, and there's only one way I think we can end this conversation.